From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Eric Westervelt. In this episode, we talk to guitarist Eric Clapton about his tribute album to the late J.J. Cale. It's called The Breeze.
I started to feel quite mildly outraged that he hadn't got the recognition that he should have had.
The new Scarlett Johansson movie, Lucy, is a big box office draw that follows the life of a woman whose superpower is using 100% of her brain. We talked to neuroscientists about the myth that people only use 10%.
Which is to say, we do use 100% of our brain.
And we visit the East Bay School for Boys to explore its innovative approach to educating middle school students.
I think boy energy has been misunderstood.
That's all in this podcast episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. New York Times correspondent Anne Bernard has just left Gaza after spending 3 weeks covering the war. I asked her how the current conflict in Gaza compares with previous episodes of fighting and bloodshed there.
The main thing that's different is that the impact on average people is huge. There's been far more strikes on people in their houses and right from the beginning of the conflict, not something that evolved later as in the previous two similar wars. So there's a sense that nowhere is safe, that there are strikes being carried out all over the place, and even if you fled, you might find that you fled to a place that was about to be hit.
And Annie, hospitals and UN schools have been hit in this latest round of fighting, and unlike Israel, there are no bomb shelters in Gaza where civilians can take shelter. You witnessed some heart-wrenching scenes at El Shifa, Gaza City's main hospital. Can you tell us some of what you saw there?
Well, Shifa Hospital was incredibly chaotic. There were exhausted doctors and nurses just working essentially round the clock, sometimes not even having time to clean up the blood from the floor. But really, it's the small things that you notice. Like, I saw a little girl just crying for her mother. Then at the next table, there was a little girl who was being pronounced dead alone without any family around her. You notice things like one man running around crying after having been told that his wife was dead, and no one in the crowd could bring themselves to tell him that his children were also dead.
I remember similar heart-wrenching scenes when I covered Gaza. Hamas has already paid a big price, Annie. Over 1,000 dead, the majority of them civilians, thousands more injured. Once again, neighborhoods have been destroyed. I'm curious, politically and strategically, has Hamas gained anything of substance from this latest conflict?
Strategically, their aim is to get the near blockade of Gaza lifted. I'm not sure that's going to happen from this, and there's a danger of ending up in the same situation, the same stalemate that existed with Israel before. Another question is whether the population will be angry at Hamas for the fact that there are no bomb shelters here, the fact that civilians took the brunt of the casualties while Hamas was able to hide in sophisticated tunnels. That said, before this happened, people were frustrated with Hamas. Salaries weren't being paid. Loyalties were maybe 50-50 between Hamas and its main rival, Fatah. Now it's 100% with the resistance, meaning Hamas.
The tunnel network in Gaza's south has been used for years to get goods and weapons into Gaza. It's been a kind of lifeline for Hamas, and Israel has regularly bombed it. But their expansive tunnel system near the border with Israel seems to have added some new twist to this latest round of fighting, has it?
Yes, I think so, because even during an intensive ground invasion, Hamas was able to infiltrate Israel several times in several different places. So a conflict that started out as being said to be about rockets is now focused as well on tunnels.
Now, the more moderate Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank advocates a negotiated peace deal with Israel. Those peace talks have gone nowhere, and he's long been seen as weak and ineffectual. Do you think the conflict has further eroded Abbas's standing among the Palestinian people?
Well, yes, I think so, because the whole idea of how the political problem was going to be solved before this conflict broke out was that there was supposed to be a national consensus government that included Abbas's Fatah party and Hamas. That government was essentially unable to govern in Gaza or really to be effective anywhere. And now there's a question of who is going to be the legitimate government in Gaza going forward.
Anne Bernard is a correspondent for the New York Times. Annie, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This summer, All Things Considered has been taking a look at the changing lives of men in America. And that means talking about how we educate boys. In Berkeley, California, a private nonprofit middle school called the East Bay School for Boys is trying to reimagine what it means to build confident young men. I took a trip to the middle school just before the end of the school year. As class gave way to lunchtime, the halls filled with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, many of whom were winding up for summer, and happy to give me an exuberant welcome.
What are you guys getting ready to do?
In some ways, the school's different approach starts with directing, not stifling, boys' sometimes frenetic energy.
I think boy energy has been misunderstood. And instead of squashing it and squelching their energy and their enthusiasm for things, at our school we channel it and we work with it.
That's language arts teacher Lisa Hale.
Knowing that I see that they have this energy and that they need help managing it instead of coming at them in a punitive way, I'd rather manage it than punish it. It's that simple.
East Bay director Jason Baton says the aim is to create an educational space where boys can make mistakes, be vulnerable, and learn to be self-reliant.
We all came together and decided what we wanted our graduates to look like what qualities we wanted them to have. So things like respects women, flexible, resilient.
Now this is still a private school in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it's not cheap. Families pay more than $20,000 a year to send their sons here. But the school has made an effort to make sure their vision of masculinity isn't just for the privileged and the white. More than half of the students here get some type of tuition assistance. More than 70% come from public elementary schools. And nearly half of the boys here identify as non-white or mixed race. One way the school is trying to upend tradition is by reinventing shop class for the 21st century. When I visited, they were finishing up an assignment to build tools for an imagined superhero with a social mission.
What do you got there? What are you showing?
This is my Warhammer. We're working on it for, I think almost the whole work class over the school year.
Eighth grader Jaden Yu, who's 14, shows me a massive metal hammer he's built. Part Thor, part Lord of the Rings.
You want to lift it?
Yeah, sure. We're looking at 4-foot-high steel pipe with a giant Thor spike.
Filled with concrete.
Wow. That's super heavy. Wow.
Yu says his superhero's mission is to fight poverty.
What this is for is destroying old buildings so that new ones can be rebuilt, old buildings that aren't being used so that new ones can be built for homes for homeless people, people who need it.
Shop classes have dropped off the curriculum at middle and high schools nationwide. Here in L.A., around 90% of traditional shop classes have been eliminated. What's called career and technical education still exists, but they're almost always electives, and the most popular classes nationwide are information technology, health sciences, and business, not hands-on technical classes such as carpentry or auto shop. But 8th grader Jaden Yu says this class has helped him prepare for his future.
It teaches you how to make stuff for yourself. If you ever need to, maybe make a door or a frame for a door or a fence, now we know how to do that, so you can make that at home now.
Here at East Bay, the boys help build everything from cubbies to apps to the very desks they use. Here, shop class, a.k.a. work, is one of just 6 main classes Jaden and all the boys take. It's seen as having equal value alongside math and language arts and physical education. Teacher David Clifford.
All we're asking the boys to do is to think about what they value, what they're good at, what they're challenged by, and what difference they want to make in the world.
The school ties work class into the curriculum. Like on the day I was there, boys were finishing up replica Civil War officers' chairs, which were paired with biographies of the Union officers who sat in them. Clifford says teaching these kinds of hard skills is vital for boys and girls. Not only do they graduate knowing how to use a table saw and welder, but he says the work fosters creativity and resilience. Director Jason Baton says that mixture of so-called hard and soft skills is central to this school's mission.
Because the real important part about being a man is taking accountability for your actions, living your life really fully and in a really present way, and loving people fully.
The East Bay School for Boys is still evolving. The school itself is new. Their first class began in the fall of 2010. And a big question is, can aspects of this holistic approach to educating boys work in America's public middle schools? The statistics there are sobering. Boys drop out of school and get suspended at much higher rates than their female counterparts. Federal statistics show that 75% of kids who are suspended multiple times and expelled are boys, many of whom will never have access to this kind of progressive and expensive school. If you went to the movie theater this weekend, you might have caught the latest Scarlett Johansson action movie called Lucy. It's about a woman who develops superpowers by harnessing the full potential of her brain.
I'm able to do things I've never done before. I feel everything, and I can control the elements around me.
That's amazing.
You've probably heard this idea before. Most people only use 10% of their brains. The other 90% is basically dormant. Well, in the movie Lucy, Morgan Freeman gives us this what-if scenario.
What if there was a way of accessing 100% of our brain? What might we be capable of?
We would be capable of exactly what we're doing now, which is to say, we do use 100% of our brain.
That is David Eagleman.
I'm a neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine.
And he says basically all of us are like Lucy. We use all of our brains, all of the time.
Even when you're just sitting around doing nothing, your brain is screaming with activity all the time, around the clock. Even when you're asleep, it's screaming with activity.
In other words, this is a total myth. Very wrong, but still very popular. Take this clip from an Ellen DeGeneres stand-up special.
It's true, they say we use 10% of our brain. 10% of our brain. And I think, imagine what we could accomplish if we used the other 60%. Do you know what I'm saying?
Let's say the average person uses 10% of their brain.
It's even in the movie Tommy Boy.
How much do you use? 1.5%. The rest is clogged with malted hops and bong resin.
Ariana Anderson is a researcher at UCLA. She looks at brain scans all day long. And she says if someone were actually using just 10% of their brain capacity...
Well, they would probably be declared brain dead.
Sorry, Tommy Boy. No one knows exactly where this myth came from, but it's been around since at least the early 1900s. So why is this wrong idea still so popular?
Probably gives us some sort of hope that if we are doing things we shouldn't do, such as watching too much TV, alcohol abuse, well, it might be damaging our brain, but it's probably damaging the 90% that we don't use. And that's not true. Whenever you're doing something that damages your brain, it's damaging something that's being used, and it's going to leave some sort of deficit behind.
For a long time, I've wondered, why is this such a sticky myth?
Again, David Eagleman.
And I think it's because it gives us a sense that there's something there to be unlocked, that we could be so much better than we could. And really, this has the same appeal as any fairy tale or superhero story. I mean, it's the neural equivalent to Peter Parker becoming Spider-Man.
In other words, it's an idea that belongs in Hollywood. That's the voice of Finn Greenall. As a musician, he's truly come a long way. He spent a decade making his name in the electronic music scene as a producer and DJ before taking a sharp turn to singer-songwriter. In 2006, he released the first album with his band, Fink. Their latest album is called Hard Believer. It's the fifth studio album with guitarist and drummer Tim Thornton and bassist Guy Whitaker. I asked Greenall how his collaboration process with them has evolved over the years.
Well, they're staring at me right now through the control room screen, so I have to be nice. In the early days, in 2006, I was very much an electronic producer trying to be a singer-songwriter, so I was a control freak. I had to relinquish my control freakery to, if I needed a drum beat, I'd ask Tim to do the drums. If I needed a bass line, I'd ask Guy to do the bass line. It's lovely to share the burden with two of your closest friends.
Oh, it's already. Oh, not as heavy as before. Come along. Come along.
You know, the title track, Hard Believer, it's a bluesy, soulful, and for me, a little darkly catchy tune. Tell us about writing Hard Believer.
I just wanted to write a song about having faith in yourself, and sometimes the creative process, half the battle is persuading yourself, come on, man, you know, don't think about the judgment, just get it done.
I can see the light coming.
It's easily one of the favourite moments I've ever put on record for me. It's a live take in the studio, and I hope that people can hear the belief in that recording. We were really believing in it when we did it.
A live take, Embrace the Blues, it's a great tune. Some singer-songwriters can be so sort of overly earnest, you want to whack them with a wet noodle, and you guys just never go there, so thank you for that.
Thank you, thanks for saying that. I get asked quite a lot in interviews, you know, where'd you get all your material from? I think they think I'm just a serial data just to get dumped to get material, you know, and it's just life.
This is a song about somebody else. So don't worry yourself, the devil's right there in the details. You don't wanna hurt yourself, or looking too close, or looking too close.
Then you've switched gears big time in your career. I mean, you started out as a club DJ, an electronic producer, and you gained a pretty big international following. Tell me a little bit about that transition when you decided to sort of hang up your headphones and start to write your own tune.
It was a long transition, and I was signed to, and still am signed to, Ninja Tune Records, a big independent kind of European dance label, and you know, in the 90s, the whole electronic dance music thing, it was a revolution to us. We bypassed the industry and made our own records. And, you know, for 7 years, I didn't have a manager or an agent or a lawyer. And, I don't know, it came to a point where I was doing gigs as a DJ and kind of not loving it. And if music's your life and you fall out of love with it, then that can be a pretty difficult space to be in, you know. So I was lucky enough to work with Amy Winehouse in the early days before she was signed, and just making beats for her and writing songs with her and hanging out. And sometimes dance music is a lot of sitting in a room on your own clicking a mouse, and working with Amy was the absolute opposite of that. And after sort of 10 years of being part of the revolution that was trying to kill off the song and kill off the band, I kind of suddenly realized, I kind of get it now. So yeah, I spent 3 or 4 years kind of retooling and teaching myself to sing and play guitar and write. And we actually told the record label that the guy singing on the record was actually an American kid that I'd found who was 20 and looked like Brad Pitt, obviously, something like that. And we didn't tell them it was me at all. We wanted an honest feedback on it, you know. And it was only when they needed to start arranging tours and live gigs, and our first single, Pretty Little Thing, was kind of pretty big, and we needed to do TV and all that kind of stuff, that they said, okay, let's meet this guy. And I was like, yeah, it's actually me. And the CEO literally fell off his chair.
That's amazing. He was literally fell out of his chair.
He literally fell off his seat. Yeah, he was
suddenly
kind of,
this famous electronic music label is putting out a singer-songwriter.
Pretty little thing.
I'm speaking with musician Finn Greenall. His latest album with the trio Fink is Hard Believer. You know, dance music, you know people are into it because they're getting up and moving. When you're up there doing, you know, another song off the new album, it's a different kind of feedback from the audience. They're not shaking it on the dance floor, per se. I guess I'm curious, in terms of audience feedback, how are you getting that when it's so different from when you were a DJ?
Absolutely, it's totally different. And instead of judging it with everybody moving around and making a lot of noise, if everybody's completely silent, you know that something's going on.
You sort of develop your own mental, emotional applause meter. You know what the audience is sort of saying.
Absolutely. I mean, you can feel it. And I remember the finest moment I think we've had on stage with applause was we did this concert with the Royal Concertgebouw Symphony Orchestra in Holland. We were super nervous with this 100-piece orchestra, and we came on stage very nervous and played a track called Berlin Sunrise. Berlin Sunrise. Calm down, babe. With a symphony orchestra, which we learned, there wasn't any options of Finn's decided to do an extra ending, so everybody just jam along. It's really not an option. We finished the track, and then because in classical music you don't kind of clap after each track, there was a pause of about, I don't know, it felt like a minute, but it was probably like 2 seconds. And then we got this beautiful, enormous round of applause. We just knew that the audience had kind of almost breathed a collective sigh of relief too.
You had as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All of us, all 5,000 people and the band and the orchestra kind of went, phew, okay, this is going to work out. This is going to be good. And that was a beautiful moment, really, really wonderful moment.
Finn Greenall with the band Fink. Their new album is Hard Believer. Finn, it's been a real pleasure.
Hey, it's been a pleasure, Eric. Thanks for having me, man. Cheers.
When actor Philip Seymour Hoffman died of a heroin overdose in February, he left behind several unreleased films. His most significant role, the haggard German intelligence agent Gunter Bachmann in the spy thriller A Most Wanted Man. Here he is in a scene with actress Robin Wright.
You ever ask yourself that question? Why we do what we do?
Sometimes. But I always come back to the same answer.
And what is it?
Make the world a safer place.
Hoffman's character leads a fictional intelligence unit that's tasked with recruiting informants within the Islamic community to uncover terrorist plots. The film's based on the 2008 John le Carré novel by the same name. It's set in Hamburg, Germany, more than 10 years after 9/11. It's a riveting spy thriller, but one without explosions, chases, and kung fu fighting. Director Anton Corbijn says one of his goals was to capture the mundane intensity in the art of spycraft.
People get so used to spy films being like Jason Bourne or James Bond. And of course they make great action films that way, but it's not so close to reality.
The film comes out at a delicate time, following revelations of NSA spying on ordinary Americans, civil liberties concerns, and Germany's recent expulsion of America's CIA station chief for recruiting agents within the German government.
One of the reasons why I wanted to make the film is that after 9/11, I think the polarization of the world has taken another pace. And what worries me is that we judge people so very quickly, you know, as to be good or bad. It's scary. And in the movie, we look at the person and think, well, if 1% of this person is bad, does it make the person 100% bad? And some people in the film think that is the case, and other people... It is difficult when there is no middle ground anymore where we can judge people properly.
Mm. In real life, Anton, Mohammed Atta and other 9/11 conspirators did plan and plot attacks based out of Hamburg. They sort of hid in plain sight in that city. In your movie, A Most Wanted Man, I mean, is that embarrassment sort of still hanging over the characters in the film?
Yes, I think that's why there are two secret services working kind of together. They split the secret services up in order to avoid missing these kind of signs. And the main character, Bachmann, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is a sort of alternative, if you like, part of the secret services that has its own way to do things.
Your choice is between us and nobody. The clock is ticking.
The film stars the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, and you're relatively new to feature film directing. I mean, how was it working with Hoffman? Did it click right away, or did it take a bit of work?
Great actors all have their own way of working and their own insecurities, as much as directors have, I guess. So you always have to feel each other out, as it were, when you start working together. Mm. But after a while, we knew exactly where we were standing, I think. I so enjoyed working with him, and it was such a delight to watch him taking on that character. You know, as a photographer, I guess I could watch him for hours just smoking a cigarette.
Right. I want to play a clip for you of Hoffman talking about working with you from a promotional video.
If I need to go to him for help, he'll give what he can. But he also will let me do what I need to do to get what to kind of get where I need to go. He just doesn't get in your way. And in fact, he lets you run with the ball.
I mean, were there things that he needed help with that he came to you for, Anton?
Probably small things, you know. It's not unlike my photography. I direct to a degree and then let people be themselves. So Philip knew that character better than anybody. I think maybe knew him better even than John Le Carré. It was scary how he inhabited that person so fully. In a way, much more of a sign of an amazing actor to make the ordinary extraordinary rather than creating an eccentric figure.
Well, it's a terrific performance. And in your film, he plays this intense, hard-drinking agent sort of on the edge of a wipeout. And he looks pretty physically rough in the movie. How much of that was for the role as an actor versus what we know now as his real-life demons and problems?
Well, I mean, the physicality is what he did bring to the role. I always wanted the Bachman character to have a physique not unlike Phillips. And there maybe are some similarities to how we lived at the time, which makes it a little harder to watch for me, knowing that in hindsight. But for the character, it was fantastic, of course. Maybe he let some of his own life spill into that character.
Well, I found it all the more poignant and powerful knowing that this was his last role. And it's hard not to look at his performance through the lens, at least a little bit, of his own personal struggles. But is that unfair for viewers to look at Hoffman's art in part through his personal life?
Well, it's very hard to erase something that you know. But I like to think that Philip's performance is amazing, full stop, whatever happened. And it's worth watching just for the performance alone.
It seems like your work as a photographer obviously deeply affects how you approach directing films, but do you ever find these two things less than compatible, where you're the sort of photographer self wants to linger longer than, say, producers would want you to?
Yeah, I guess, yes. You know, I'm a very European kind of director, and as soon as Americans get involved, my films start to be called slow. But especially with this film, I wanted the film to have an urgency, and I used handheld camera. But the step from being a photographer to a filmmaker was harder and much less logic than people assume, I think.
So you've done several terrific films, but you feel like you're still learning, still growing as a filmmaker.
Oh, I like to think so, yeah.
Film director Anton Corbijn's new film is A Most Wanted Man. Anton, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
The Harrier jet combines the speed of a fighter plane with the maneuverability of a helicopter. These single-seater jets are known for their vertical takeoff and landing, ideal for close air support near the front lines. Designed by the British and now flown by the U.S. Marine Corps, Harriers have an accident-prone track record and are notoriously difficult to fly. But why not have one for your private collection? Yesterday, a 1976 Harrier sold at the Silverstone auctions in England for the equivalent of nearly $180,000. The weapon systems are dismantled and the engine isn't fitted to the plane, but with a little work, it could fly again. If a civilian flying a Harrier sounds ridiculous, well, there's already a guy doing it.
Hi, my name is Art Knowles, and I'm a retired Marine Corps pilot.
Knowles says he's the only civilian in the world to privately own and fly a Harrier. He's got a history with these planes. The first time he sat in the cockpit of one was 35 years ago.
I had the great fortune to fly about 75 different type model series of airplanes, most of them pretty exciting, F-18, F-16. But my absolute favorite has and always will be the Harrier.
That's why Knowles bought one. Back in 2006, a Sea Harrier went up for sale in the UK. Like the Harrier from this weekend's auction, it had no weapon systems and it was no longer equipped to fly. But Knowles was determined to get it back in the air.
The FAA was on board. The bank was on board. He offered it up for sale, and I was the first one there with a checkbook.
As for what he paid for this rare 1979 Sea Harrier, Knowles won't say.
We shook hands on a deal and signed a one-page contract written in Sharpie, and I headed back to the United States.
Meanwhile, the plane was taken apart, loaded onto a ship, and sent to the U.S. Then Knowles and his crew painstakingly put it all back together. If you're wondering what a manual for a Harrier looks like...
It's about 400,000 pages.
Instructions on landing gear, gas turbine jet engine starters, wiring diagrams.
We started following the instructions step by step by step by step.
Finally, his plane was restored and airborne.
It can come to a complete stop in the air. It can back up. It can turn sideways.
Those big Rolls-Royce engines roar. It takes a lot of thrust to keep these planes hovering.
Well, it burns a little bit of gas. When we're in the hover, we're burning a gallon of fuel, jet fuel, every 2 seconds. 1,001, 1,002. That was a gallon of jet fuel right there.
Knowles now travels the country, taking his Sea Harrier to air shows like the Langley Air Show in Virginia.
How about that? He backed it up like a school bus. Art Knowles.
When we're at an air show, I love the opportunity to be able to share it with other people.
And now with another private collector buying a Harrier at this weekend's auction, Knowles is also willing to share his expertise. He says he's available to help get that Harrier back in the air, too.
There's no reason that a competent pilot who had been properly instructed and trained couldn't, with the right supervision, safely fly this airplane.
Retired Marine aviator Art Knowles, the pilot of his own private Harrier jump jet. There are, you could argue, two strands of Eric Clapton fans. Those who love this electric guitar giant for his groundbreaking fusion of blues and rock, inventive solos that launched a million guitar lessons. And then there are those who prefer Clapton's mellow, unplugged pop songs from later years. The two veins of Clapton fans just might find common ground on his new album. I make rock and roll records. I sell them for a dime. I make my living, feed my children on your good time. The Breeze, an appreciation of J.J. Cale, will be released next week. It's an all-star tribute to Clapton's friend, the guitarist and singer-songwriter from Tulsa, Oklahoma, who deeply inspired Clapton and also wrote two of his biggest hits.
You know, when I did After Midnight and Cocaine, I was really trying as hard as I could to sound like him. So he summed up so many of the different essences of American music, you know, rock and jazz and folk and blues, and he just seemed to have an understanding of it all.
J.J. Cale died exactly 1 year ago today. Clapton says he woke up the next morning to find a text message about Cale's passing. And on the long flight to L.A. for the funeral, Clapton began to map out the new album.
I planned the whole thing. I just selected the songs to do. I even came up with the idea for the artwork and the title and to a certain extent, the content. And then when I got to Escondido and we went to the service and I met his wife, Christine, and his manager, Mike Kappas, and we paid our respects to one another and gave one another hugs. And I said, I'd like to make a record to pay tribute to John. How do you feel? And they said, well, that will be great. There was no hesitation as far as I could see. And that was, you know, very moving for me that they gave me their trust to do this, you know. Making this record was a way for me to say thank you for all the inspiration over the years. And, you know, I suppose at some point I started to feel quite, you know, mildly outraged that he hadn't got the recognition that at least I thought he should have had.
You know, from the interviews I've heard with J.J. Cale, he didn't
really seem to mind that he never became famous in the way you did. Do you think he cared much or not?
I think he saw his job or his vocation as a musician on the same sort of scale as someone who likes to do landscape gardening or, you know, an architect. He just thought it was something that you could develop a skill at, be good at, get some satisfaction. So I don't think he recognized that all of the other paraphernalia was necessary.
So it was a benefit in that sense?
Well, those of us who discovered him. For me, he was a beacon in a philosophical sense too, because I needed to know that there was someone else out there that didn't want all those trappings too. You know, when I was growing up in the rock and roll school in England in the 60s, it just seemed to be a given that everyone was going to end up on TV, and the ambition was to have a top 10 single. And I felt really alone in the fact that I didn't want any. I just wanted to become reasonably good at what I was doing.
And you wrote in your autobiography, you know, you were a bit tired of the guitar hero thing and the gymnastic guitar playing. So it sounds like J.J. Cale helped to start to dial you back to be a little more restrained, perhaps, in the soloing. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it was getting out of control. You know, heavy metal came out of all of that stuff until it was like volume and proficiency and virtuosity. There didn't seem to be any reasonable limit to that. It was just crazy. And so I wanted to go in the other direction and try to find a way to make it minimal, but you still have a great deal of substance. I mean, that was the essence of JJ's music.
We're speaking with Eric Clapton about his new album, The Breeze, an appreciation of J.J. Cale. And how did it come about working with such an incredible collection of musician friends of yours? I mean, did you just start calling up John Mayer, Tom Petty, Mark Knopfler, and Willie Nelson saying, do you want in on this?
I started out with my partner, Simon. We went into the studio and we started to just collate material. And then we took it to L.A. 3 weeks later and put Jim Keltner and Nathan East in as the rhythm section, and invited a lot of JJ's friends from Tulsa to come down and hang out and play. And we turned it into a big party. And then later on, you know, started to share out the vocals. And at that point, you know, I knew I wanted Tom, and Tom wanted to do it. And John Mayer had already done a little tribute on stage to John, and so he was a logical choice.
Magnolia, you sweet thing, you're driving me mad. Gotta get back to you, babe. You're the best I ever had.
Initially, actually, the first person I asked was Don White, and I'd never met Don White until the funeral. And he introduced himself to me and said, "I'd like to say hello. I'm the guy that gave John his first job." And it turned out that JJ played in his band. And I was really impressed with this guy. He's a gentleman, you know. And I said, "Well, I'd like, if it's okay, I'm going to do this album. And I was going to sing it all myself, but now would you like to come and sing a couple of songs?" And he said yes, and that began it, the whole thing, you know.
The goal is never what it is, the goal will never be. The light stays dim a long time now, it's hard for you to see. Talk about a pathway, way beyond your sight. Another time, another mind, that is the way of life.
You recorded the album The Road to Escondido with him in 2006. What will you remember from those sessions now that JJ's gone?
Well, his extraordinary sense of humor, his skill, his tenacity. He was a pretty social guy, actually. I mean, you know, the word out about JJ was that, you know, that if you didn't know anything about him, that he was reclusive and shy. In fact, he was pretty gregarious character. He just liked to make music, and he liked to do it in his own way. And so, but if you got him into in the company of his friends and with other musicians, he liked to have fun. So, you know, I remember those sessions as being extremely lively and funny, It's a treasure to me. It's a great memory.
You're the only artist to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame three different times, and so far J.J. Cale is not an inductee. I mean, do you think this is a painful oversight that needs to be changed?
Yeah, I do. I would say it was a little bit careless. Maybe that it's in the pipeline, but it's a shame that it would happen posthumously, I think. I regard him as, you know, one of the roots of the tree in American folklore. He was my idol, and that, you know, you want, I suppose, when we're fans of people, we want other people to recognize him too.
You said you love me. I can see through that. Lies, lies, lies.
That's Eric Clapton. His new tribute album is called The Breeze, an appreciation of J.J. Cale. Mr. Clapton, thank you so much for all you've done. It's been a real privilege speaking with you.
Thanks very much, man. Take care.
You said you loved me, then you left with him. Lord, you did to me. I see it in your eyes.
For the week ending July 27th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, and Denise Guerra. Our intern is Jen Velez. Patrick Murray is the technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Eric Westervelt. Follow me on Twitter at EricNPR. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.